Peace and love, everybody.
Ringo
here. Beautiful day in LA.
So, it was good to be able to kind of get it out in a song.
The whole, you know, origin of where we're all coming from.
I'm prepared for death because I don't believe in it. I think it's just getting out of one car and getting into another.
Hello, Solo Beetle fans, and welcome to Talk More Talk, a Solo Beetles video cast. I am one of your four co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi, and you may know me from my show, Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. Today, we have an action-filled show today, so we might run a little long, but we're going to try to keep it to as close to an hour as possible. Let me introduce to you my three co-hosts. First, he is the DJ of the great show Every Little Thing that's been running now for over 36 years now, I believe it is. And he's also the co-host of Things We Said Today, my favorite Beatles podcast. He is the one and only Ken Michaels. Ken, hello.
Hi, Tom. Hi, everybody. It just made 37 years.
37 years of Every Little Thing. And you do play Every Little Thing, and I'm proud to say I listen to that show.
Thank you.
So, next up, she is the queen of all Beatles media. I mean, I would hope that you guys all know that by now. She is the author of Songs We Were Singing, Guided Tours Through the Beatles' Lesser Known Tracks. And is she hatless? I don't know. I can't see anybody. I'm writing blind here right now. So she is Dr. Kit O'Toole. Kit, how are we doing?
I'm doing great, Tom. Hi, guys, and hi, everybody out there. Oh, I made kind of a pun. I didn't mean to do that, but see, on this show, people get it.
People get it. All right. And last but certainly not least, he is the author of the George Martin Bios, Volume 1, Maximum Volume, Volume 2, Sound Pictures, and a special announcement coming up real soon. He is the one and only Dr. Kenneth Womack. Doc, how we doing?
Doing great. Good to see you guys.
It's a pleasure as always. Like I said, we are going to have an action-packed show. We're going to recap the fest for Beatles fans. We're going to get into the discussion that my three co-hosts had since I wasn't able to make it. But first, here's the one and only Ken Michaels with the latest and greatest. Ken, as always, take it away.
Well, I thought we'd start off the show by making the big announcement, as you were just hinting, Tom, of, well, this is the major announcement, the biggest announcement of the week. This is what everybody's talking about all over the internet, and that's Ken's brand new book on Abbey Road. Want to tell us more about that, Ken?
Sure. It's the story of really the last year of the Beatles, mostly the story of the making of Abbey Road in that wonderful summer 50 years ago. It has a few, as you might imagine, flashbacks to key events that brought the Beatles to that place, the kind of political events inside the band, the social events that were affecting them. But mostly it's about the music. And of course, tells us about the making of Abbey Road and then takes us into the aftermath and why the Beatles just couldn't push on another day. So I'm very proud. I'm very proud of it. And it's called Solid State because it's about the technology too that helped make the record, and of course I'm talking about the transistor recording desk that helped make it all happen, transistor mixing desk rather, that made it all happen, the 8-track, the whole business that gives it such a different sound, right? That warmth that we also hear on what songs like Maybe I'm Amazed, which were made on the same desk. So very happy with it. Alan Parsons wrote a great foreword to kick things off. And of course he would know better than I anyway. So really proud of it and looking forward to seeing what you guys think.
Okay. Awesome. And that's coming out when? The release date is when?
It's officially October 15th, but you might see earlier. Of course, you as my special colleagues, you might even see it earlier.
Yes. I would hope so. I should hope so.
Don't tease us, Ken.
Right after the Cats, you're 5, 6, and 7.
Oh, man.
Well, to go along with that is the news about the Abbey Road Symposium that we've talked about before, which is taking place at the University of Rochester. That's the last weekend of September. And you broke the news also, Ken, about there will be a live stream for that.
And that's right. It'll be the conference will be, in fact, the weekend of September 27th this year. And it will be held at the University of Rochester in the Eastman School of Music. Given that town's storied history, of course, with Eastman, and Kodak, et cetera. So, it's going to be a pretty exciting time. I understand Andy Babuke will be there. We know him as the scholar of Beatles instrumentation. Also on hand will be, Walter Everett, the author of The Beatles Use Musicians, John Kurlander, whom I will be interviewing, I guess live on stream. John will be there to tell us about how he saved Her Majesty and more. And of course, those who are on Facebook probably saw John's announcement that reminding us that 50 years ago he was on that session for the Ballad of John and Yoko.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yep.
Okay. So should we talk about the fest first or should we do more news?
Let's get the news.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, some news that broke about a week ago is that there'll be a new film documentary coming out May the 24th at the ArcLight Cinerama Dome in Los Angeles. It's called Echoes of the Canyon. It's about music from the 60s from Laurel Canyon, groups like the Byrds, Buffalo Springfield, Mamas and Papas, and the Beach Boys. Ringo Starr is interviewed in the film, as are the surviving members from those groups that I just mentioned. Eric Clapton, Beck, Jackson Browne, Lou Adler, and others are all interviewed. And it's said that the last film interview that Tom Petty gave was in this documentary. Jacob Dylan serves as the narrator. He's also an interviewer and co-producer for the film. And there'll also be an album coming out with Jacob Dylan, Cat Power, Regina Spektor, and Beck interpreting songs from the Laurel Canyon songbook. So we have that date of May 24th for that theater in Los Angeles. And let's hope that it has a more widespread release in theaters. Also, Paul McCartney is now making available the film, The Bruce McMahon Show, which you can purchase as a download or you can rent it. It's now available on iTunes. And as we all know, it's part animation, part live concert footage of Wings from their 1972 European tour. While it's not confirmed, Michael Eavis, the co-creator of the Glastonbury Festival, has been teasing people by saying that he's hoping that Paul McCartney will play their 50th anniversary festival next year. Paul was also rumored to headline this year's festival. And we all know that he played Glastonbury back in 2004.
Right.
So let's hope that he does it next year. And we were talking about this in our last show, not the one from the fest, but Paul did indeed play back in Brazil, and also in Chile. I think he did not play it in Argentina when I looked at the set list. Paul doesn't start his tour of the U.S. until May 23rd in New Orleans. But good to hear that he did play back in Brazil there. I have a feeling he's not going to do it when he comes to the States.
Yeah, probably not.
Sorry to hear about the death of Johnny Hutch Hutchinson, who was one of the greatest of the Merseyside drummers. He was the drummer for the band The Big Three, considered one of the finest of the Liverpool scene. When the group disbanded, Johnny gave up his music career for good. Johnny is said to have despised the Beatles as people and as musicians in all their time together. Johnny will always be remembered for standing in for the Beatles for the drummer at the time, Tommy Moore, when they had an audition for Larry Parnes. He also played with the Beatles right after Pete Best was fired from the group, just briefly before Ringo arrived. And there's a quote from him where he says, "Brian asked me to join the Beatles, and I said, I wouldn't join the Beatles for a gold clock. There's only one group as far as I'm concerned, and that's the Big Three. The Beatles can make a better sound than that, and Pete Best is a very good friend of mine, I couldn't do the dirty on him.
Nice. He was very colorful. There's no doubt about that.
That's for sure. But
you know what? I would leave all of you for a gold clock. Or individually.
Thanks.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks. We appreciate that.
Yeah.
I didn't mean nice you, cool. Ken.
But... Oh, okay. Oh. Gotta single me out there.
The Kens must stay together.
That's right.
That's true. We're locked together.
That's right.
I guess you guys know about this, but the Beatles recording of Help is now being used in a TV commercial for Google.
Yeah.
A lot of people are upset about this, and we can all go back to the late 80s when there was a lot of controversy when Revolution was used in a Nike commercial on television. But I think what a lot of people are upset about is the fact that it's the Beatles' own recording. There have been a lot of covers of Beatles songs that have been used in Beatles commercials, but not their own recording of their songs. And I can't remember, other than Revolution, when it's happened except here. But how do you guys feel about that? Just curious, the fact that a Beatles recording is actually being used, the actual recording from the Beatles in a TV commercial. Does it matter at all to you?
Well, I mean, I don't love it. I mean, I will admit. But, you know, I guess it's just sort of inevitable. I mean, there are so many iconic songs that are now being used in commercials. It's amazing how, I mean, remember back in the 80s when Revolution, you know, was used in the Nike ad, as you said. And I mean, it was scandalous. I mean, it was such a huge controversy, and eventually it was taken off the air. That stigma seems to have largely gone away, because I mean, I've heard Stone songs, I've heard, you know, many others and the original recordings, and you know, you don't hear the blowback like that like you used to, you know, with the Revolution commercial. So while I don't love it, at least it's not for toilet paper, you know, then you know, something like that, then I might be a little more upset. But you know, for Google, that's not so bad.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, Ken, I think you said it best on that on your latest and extra long episode of Things We Said Today, where, you know, you commented where if, you know, if the younger generation hears that song and they like it and they go out and they buy, you know, Help, and then it leads them to getting that, you know, the album Help, and then if it leads them to getting the rest of the catalog, then I say, you know, for that reason, then great.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Ken, any thoughts?
Yeah, well, I'm just still I'm still back on at least it's not for toilet paper. That's why she's the queen. I mean, that
you that, bet
those gems just roll out of that mouth.
Yeah,
first class all the way.
Yeah,
it must be the scribble on her paper.
Yeah,
I agree. In the 80s, it did seem preposterous when the Revolution ad appeared, but. I think the Beatles have achieved blue chip status in so many other ways at this point that an occasional commercial like that wouldn't bother me. You know, in fact, my gosh, I mean, the difference between now and what year was that? 87 when that occurred?
Around there.
Yeah. Is just so different, right? Because of the proliferation of so many different formats and ways to, you know, move content around the internet, and it just seems it seems like a minor thing at this point. It was jarring because it's such a rarity, but and it was done in good taste. I've heard, in fact, I was in the city yesterday, and a fellow I was with mentioned that he thought, you know, it was done pretty well, and he liked it.
Right.
So
you know, it really works in this context because you need Google to help you find information. And they even have the front cover of the Help album towards the end for a split second. And I believe at the very end of the commercial, it says, with a little help.
Yes.
You know, from Google.
Yep.
So, there's so much competition out there.
Yep.
What's that?
We have a viewer question. Who do the royalties go to for that these days?
Well, they go to the same people they always have.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, you know, ATV, Sony ATV, whatever we're calling them these days, you know, they're the agent.
Yep.
And as the agent, they get a you know, they get a fee, but of course the rest of the money's going right to the Beatles and their heirs. And every year they get together and divide the spoils. So, you know, so for the most part, it's going to the Beatles and their heirs and Sony ATV or whatever we're calling them. I should know this. I think it's Sony ATV.
I think you're right.
Yeah. And they get their cut, and that's how that works.
But in addition to the music publishing end, there's also songwriting royalties, which is a completely different thing. And I would believe that.
Well, that's what I was referring to.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So they make money as well.
Right. And then you also, let's face it, what's the benefit for, Beatles and company? It is the fact that people are then going to go out and buy Help. Mm-hmm. And Help is available on a number of compilations. It is available on as the title track, as you were mentioning earlier, of the Help album. So, you know, it's a good gateway song into the Beatles content world, which is the finest world there is.
Right. Well, as I've always said, in order for a catalog to thrive, you always need young people to discover it.
Sure.
And there's so much competition out there that to get old music played, you know, there are people out there that are paid to try to get songs in commercials or in movies or in video games. And if the music gets introduced to young people that way, I'm totally for it.
So, absolutely. And, yeah. You know, we have a great lesson on this. The Beatles, of course, have never really ebbed, despite a few moments in their post-band life. But they rule most streaming organizations year in and year out. If they're not the top, they're close to it. But all we have to look to is Elvis, right? With the embargoing of his music for so many years, students do not have a working knowledge of the King. And, you know, it's a damn shame.
Mm. Right.
Scary.
Yeah. So it's good to be out there somewhere, right?
That's true.
All right. Some other news here. This concerns Lawrence Juber, who was a fantastic guest at the Fest for Beatle Fans. He has a new CD, which is coming out April the 26th. And it's called Downtown, named after the Petula Clark song. And it's a lot of standards with one original. And he did indicate at the Fest that he will be working on his fourth CD of Beatle covers. So wow. He's done all that. Plus, he did one CD of all Wing songs called One Wing. Mm-hmm. So, terrific arrangements, all on acoustic guitar from Lawrence. Also, there's a bunch of news here on the Beatles Kids that I can run by real quick. Mm-hmm. Danny Harrison, who just recently announced that he'll be the opening act for Jeff Lynne's ELO for the North American tour, posted last Friday on Facebook that he'll be appearing on Perry Farrell's upcoming solo album, Kind Heaven, which is due out June the 7th. Zach Starkey, this is very interesting. And Sharna Liguz, that's spelled L-I-G-U-Z. They've announced the formation of a new reggae record label, which is called Trojan Jamaica. And they have a new album coming out. They call it a groundbreaking album, Red, Gold, Green, and Blue. Details will be coming soon about that. But just released for streaming and downloading is a new recording of the Screamin' Jay Hawkins song, I'll Put a Spell on You, performed by Michael, that's M-Y-K-A-L, Michael Rose, featuring Sly and Robbie. Oh. And the track was produced by Youth, the same guy that worked with Paul for the Fireman Projects. And a new video for the song is out, and Zach Starkey is in it, and he's playing electric guitar.
Interesting.
A new label there from Zach and Sharna. Julian Lane is releasing the third of a trilogy of children's books due out April the 22nd called Love the Earth, which, like his previous books, Touch the Earth and Heal the Earth, concerns his magical plane, the White Feather Flyer, which teaches children around the world about the importance of clean air and water. That's all about preserving the environment. And he'll be making a bookstore appearance at the Barnes & Noble bookstore on Union Square in New York City on April the 22nd at 7 p.m. He is also scheduled to appear on The View. And I'm not sure. I was given the date April 24th. I've looked online. I haven't had anything to confirm that. But he has been a guest on The View a few times. So it'll be after April 22nd, I'm pretty sure. Should be the 24th. He's also going to be at the Barnes & Noble in the Grove in L.A., making an in-store appearance there April the 30th. And then there's news about Sean Lennon, who, along with the Lennon, the Claypool Lennon Delirium, they're currently touring in support of their new album, which I have right here.
Just check
the reality. Mm-hmm. Yes. And for those of you that don't know, when they played in Toronto, Geddy Lee joined them on stage. And they performed Tomorrow Never Knows together.
Interesting.
And, they have performed that before. I just got to see them on Saturday night in New Haven, a College Hate Music Hall. And this is the second time I saw the band. And they performed Tomorrow Never Knows the first time, as well as in the Court of the Crimson King. Mm. And fantastic band to get to see. Now, the new CD, by the way, is just the two of them playing everything. And Sean, in fact, plays drums on the album. But this is a full band that you got to see with a keyboard player and a drummer. And Sean does all the guitar work. He does the rhythm guitar parts. He does the lead guitar parts. Wow. And it was an amazingly tight band. I really enjoyed the show. I'm getting to know the album better. It takes a while for it to grow on you. If you like psychedelic music, kind of Pink Floyd-ish, mm-hmm. kind of King Crimson-ish, I would recommend the CD.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And that is the news that I have for you this time.
All right. Very well. Okay, so our one of the main things we're going to talk about today, we're going to recap the fest, which happened March 29th to the 31st, and that was in New Jersey. And my colleagues here, the Kens and the lovely Kits, were able to go, and thankfully you guys did a panel. You guys were wonderful. We watched it on YouTube. Before we get to that, let's hear what else you guys did, because it seemed like all three of you were busy. And it looked like it was a lot of fun as well. So hopefully not only did you, you know, do a lot, but you got to see a lot and have a little bit of fun. So, Kit, why don't you talk about what else you did while you were there?
Well, I was on a number of panels, obviously Talk More Talk. I was on two historians panels where we talked about Abbey Road, talking about how it looks backwards to their roots and looks forward in terms of their solo careers. We talked about the Get Back sessions on the other panel. I did my Deep Beatles Live presentation with Steve Erickson, and we did three Escher demos. I'm not going to say what they are because we're going to be doing same thing in Chicago. Sorry, Tom.
Yeah, you made my phone drop. Thanks.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, I didn't mean to shock you.
And, yeah, okay.
Ken Womack and I got into a lot of trouble in the author area where we were selling our books and everything. We were just, you know, doing our usual wreaking havoc and, you know. Security was called now. But one of the highlights for me was seeing the 3X Wingers play back parts. I wish they played all of Back to the Egg. I'm selfish, and so that's why I'm like, oh, why didn't they play it all? But they played, you know, some tracks on, you know, Spin It On, Old Siam, Sir. That was
yes.
Cool. That was really cool. Just great to see them play these, you know, classic tracks live. I mean, stuff you never thought you'd hear live. Mm-hmm. And so that was really a big highlight for me.
Cool. Very cool. And where was Womack?
Well, I was getting in trouble in the book room, as you just heard. I sure hope Wings goes and does their thing again in Chicago. By then, I'm sure we'll get one of the box sets for Back to the Egg. Mm. Yeah, I think we'll probably be on the second one by then. Maybe the second one. The special egg crate version of it. Not the luggage. Anyway, I thought it was kind of lukewarm at first, but I thought the fest went really well after a while. There was very, very nice crowds on Saturday and Sunday. Mark Lapidus had a lot to be proud of this time out. Just a good vibe. I did a fun main stage thing where I did my George Martin's role in constructing the Abbey Road medley.
I watched that. That was great. Fantastic.
Yeah, well, thanks to the great Albert Ammons, it was. I think I'm just going to make him the only slide from now on. And everything else. I had a lot of fun doing that. He was recurring over and over again. He is determined, you know, even in death, to bring back the boogie woogie. I mean, that's it. So, you know, I did that and I had a lot of fun with you guys on our panel. I got to see, you know, we all love Kit O'Toole, of course, but I'm here to tell you she is a demon. And and I'll tell you why.
Oh, I can't wait for this.
I have a prop. I mean, you play a nice person, Kit.
Yeah.
Hold on. I'm just getting a photo here.
Oh my God.
No, oh, there you are. Oh, there you are with a Coca-Cola. That's nice.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's good. That was, by the way, real cane sugar, right?
Yes, that was a Mexican Coke, which I'd never had before.
Would you say
they're really good?
It was good.
So did you think it tasted better than your normal experience?
You know, just a little bit. I didn't see a huge difference, but there was some. I mean, it was sweeter for sure.
Now, so, yeah. Look, I'm no expert in handwriting analysis. But I'm sitting next to you during our Talk More Talk panel. I just happened to lean over with my camera, with my phone.
Yes, just happened to.
And I took a photo of this is Kit's writing. And if you can't read it, that's because it's not legible. this is the writing of a sociopath.
No.
Look, there's the word you, and then there's 33. Mm-hmm. I can see that.
But see, smart people have bad handwriting. I think there's been a study that shows that.
Yes. Yeah. Please remind me to only let you write me prescriptions in the near future. Because
yeah, see, smart people have illegible handwriting is the last thing you hear before somebody, a sociopath, kills you. I heard that's why Tom stayed away.
Yes. I scared the hell out of him, I think, at Monmouth.
You know, there's still a lot of releases coming out in the near future that I need to get, so I don't want to die, Kit.
Yeah, this is right. The buffet was really good this time.
Yes.
There you go.
Absolutely.
I have lots of other photos I can share. Here's Kit just sitting there. that was nice. Oh, here's a dog.
What you all missed out on?
Yeah. Here's a dog with a Beatles outfit.
Oh my nice. God. Was that at the fest?
Yeah.
I didn't see him.
Yeah, you know, I pay attention to what's going on.
I missed him.
Chuck Gunderson, what a guy.
Oh.
Yeah.
Great guy. Nice guy.
This is Jude Shoe.
Jude Kessler.
Yeah.
Jude Kessler, yes indeed.
That's what I've got. So
that was a good recap. Very nice.
Fantastic.
Oh, look, here's Jack Douglas getting out of his car.
Oh.
That was nice.
I saw him sitting at the hotel bar at one point.
Mm. Yeah, but what I did was stalking.
Yeah, right. Oh,
so
no.
Now,
okay.
All of our viewers feel like they've already been there now.
Yeah.
Right. It really draws you in, doesn't it?
Oh boy.
Oh, anyways, so Ken Michaels, I'm sure you have all of your updates neatly typed on a piece of paper for you to tell us what your experience. So
no. It's all here, which could be dangerous. Yeah. No, but really, ditto with what Kit said. The Wings performance was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And normally, there's Mark Lapidus there.
Normally,
if you ever see a member of Wings from the later lineup there, the last lineup, you get to hear Rockestra, maybe getting closer. But mm-hmm. they did half the album. Like you said, Old Siamser. So glad to see you here. Oh, yeah. My God, they did.
Yeah.
And Lawrence Schuber opened singing, We're Open Tonight.
Right.
You know, plus Getting Closer, mm-hmm. Spin It On. Denny Lane sang lead to Again and Again and Again. And I'm missing some of Ken's photos. I'm sorry.
I know. I'm like, I'm trying to focus on both here.
It's okay. I'm going to get it like a, you know, a photo, a feed later for you, Ken.
Oh.
Is it true that he didn't do, they didn't do Arrow Through Me?
No, they didn't.
No, they didn't.
You know, Arrow Through Me is a real tough song to sing because of the wide vocal range in it. But I got to hand it to Glenn Burtnick from the band Liverpool, who's also part of the Weaklings, because he did most of the McCartney vocals. And he's outstanding. The whole band, Liverpool, is really great.
Very good.
And aside from the fact that when they do their own song, they do their own concert, they're fantastic. I'm so impressed when they back up the guests at the fest. Because sometimes it's not that easy to back them back up certain artists on certain songs. I just want to mention one song.
Yeah.
No, but one year, Ronnie Spector was there, and they backed her up on Try Some, Buy Some, which is a mother of a song to play. It's very difficult to play Try Some, Buy Some. Lots of different time signatures in there. And so apart from the fact that they're great musicians by themselves playing the Beatles music, when they back up other people, I think that they deserve tons of credit because they do it so well. But other highlights, John Montagna, who's a bass player, who was a guest on Things We Said Today, my other podcast, did a lecture or a seminar upstairs where he showed you Paul's innovative bass playing on the Abbey Road album. And he played it along with the Beatles recordings so you can hear exactly what Paul was doing and how interesting how everything gelled on some of the Beatles songs. Bruce Spizer right there.
Yep.
You know what? We ought to get Bruce Spizer to do like a live hookup for us at the McCartney show in New Orleans.
Oh, there you go. Maybe. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll see. Maybe.
We should try and get Paul to do some Venus and Mars stuff in New Orleans. My Carnival.
Yeah. Yes.
That'd be awesome.
But John Montagna was great, and you'd have to be there to see it. And he put out one video where he's playing the bass along to something. And you could just tell how the whole band is locked in, especially Paul and Ringo, Ringo on drums there, and how everything fits in the song. Everything made sense in the way that Paul played it. Also, there were our panels. There was the one that we did for Talk More Talk, the one I did with Darren DeVivo on Things We Said Today, where we talked about how our listeners feel about all these different mixes that have come out of Beatles recordings through the years. Are you in favor of it? Does it confuse people? Is it a good thing? You know, it's a very worthy subject, I think. And Darren was kind of concerned about that because we're not just talking about the Sgt. Pepper and White Album box sets, but going back to the Yellow Submarine song track or Let It Be Naked, you know, Love, which is an entirely different animal altogether. But how our listeners felt about that, how Beatle fans felt about that. And then there was our panel, which was the Beatles media panel, where Wally Pedrazic was the moderator. And it was all about, you know, the fact that the internet, there's so much stuff now on the Beatles, and there's so many podcasts in particular. Is that a good thing? Is there too much clutter? You know, what is the importance of podcasts right now, which is a booming thing right now on the internet? I can't believe how many Beatles podcasts there are, and solo Beatle ones too, individual ones like the one you got, Tom, there with Two Legs. But it was a very interesting topic. And the Zombies were there. They were fantastic being interviewed in the main ballroom. And it was the original Zombies too. You know, and they're going to be touring again. They were just inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They hinted that they were going to work on a project with Brian Wilson, but couldn't give any details on that. And Alan White was a great guest as well. So many things. And there was also meeting the fans and talking to them about our shows. I met a 12-year-old fan named Nick, who is everything about the Beatles. Somehow he knows the group music and the solo music. He's telling me things about the solo music like he actually said to me, Ken, Press to Play is a better album than Egypt Station.
Oh, I love this kid.
He's 12 years old telling me this.
I agree with him.
How do you know all this stuff? You're 12.
You know, kid, I always like that Tough on a Tightrope.
Yep. Oh. Seriously, that is a
great song.
It is a great song. Yeah. Absolutely.
We're going to be talking about that album very shortly.
But I should add one more thing that I really liked that I forgot to mention was, you know, our author tables were near the Apple Jam stage, and it was, you know, kind of cool to see all these different artists, including a friend of this show, Scott Erickson, that we all know. He did some great sets, and there was also Black Rabbit, and I'll tell you, they killed. I mean, when they did Helter Skelter, I mean, I saw people in the audience, and some of them, you know, first generation fans, let's say, like practically headbanging. It was incredible. I mean, the drummer they had was fantastic. So that was another, you know, highlight for me. They were great.
Cool. Yeah. So
by the way, let me just say one thing, because Mr. Mayo wrote to us about the members of the Wings don't seem to know anything about a remastered Back to the Egg coming out, you know, because I asked Steve Holly about that and he was not even approached about it yet. Ooh. This was only a few weeks ago. So I hope that it's true. I mean, the rumor is that London Town and Back to the Egg are next, but I haven't seen anything to confirm it.
I wouldn't be surprised that it is true and they won't really involve them. You know, a number of the production team for the Beatles have not been involved in any of these big remixes. You know, including Ken Scott and all the others. So they probably aren't being consulted. They'll just get a contract.
But on the other hand, if you look at the Wildlife and Red Rose Speedway box sets, there's quotes from Denny Seiwell in there from a new interview. So I would think they'd be approached. And how can you not approach Denny Lane?
Yeah, you know,
he's there from start to finish in Wings.
So. Yeah, but he's a little cranky sometimes. So
that's true.
Anyways, but go ahead. Anybody else?
No, that's it, pretty much.
Okay, cool. So obviously then the highlight of the weekend was the panel you three did for Talk More Talk. It went over so well. Watched it on YouTube. It was great. Ken Michaels, why don't you just talk about what the topic was, and then we can spend a couple minutes, you know, adding whatever you guys didn't get in, and maybe I'll add in a little thing or two, and then also the
let me get out
watching.
My notes.
Yeah.
Tom, just read the notes.
Yeah. So that way, you know, and then the fans watching can, you know, they can, you know, type down their, you know, what they thought was incorporated in, you know, into the solo Beatles canon. So Ken, you know, go ahead.
Yeah. The topic was called Sing the Changes after the Fireman song. And it really was about the Beatles and their solo careers, how they adapted to changes in musical styles through the years, be it disco, new wave, whatever, maybe working with hot artists of the time. How did they reflect the different changes going on musically in musical styles from the 70s on up? And we had gotten into the early 80s talking about McCartney 2. I know we did some talk about George working with Jeff Lynne for Cloud Nine.
Yes.
But we're pretty much in the, you know, in the 80s right now. And that's right. Where we can pick up where we left off.
All right. Kit, you want to start off?
Well, you know, one of the things that I thought about that we didn't get to cover during our panel was, you know, pairing up with hot artists and, you know, duetting. And, I mean, that's a time where, I mean, Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson, that was an inspired pairing. I mean, you know, at the time, Michael was the number one artist. I mean, you know, he was riding high on Thriller. Actually, the first duet they did was just as Thriller was being recorded. But after that, then came Say, Say, Say. And I just thought it that song in particular worked extremely well because it allowed, you know, Paul to stretch a little bit, you know, brought in a little bit of R&B as well as pop. Their voices gelled very well together. And they, you know, we talked earlier about how putting Beatles songs in advertisements can bring new fans into the fold. Well, that's what it did with me, you know, as I've said before. When I heard that song, I was a huge Michael Jackson fan, and so that made me buy Pipes Apiece. And so, you know, I think it was a smart move on both their parts. You know, Michael then could appeal to, you know, the first generation Beatles fans. And, you know, so there were a generation span. So I thought that both in terms of sort of strategic move, but also in terms of the song. You know, it didn't have them. I mean, they weren't rapping. They weren't doing anything that would sound out of character, but it sounded, you know, very fresh and you know, and modern. And this became an enormous hit. So, so I think that's another way that we didn't get into as much. We didn't have time in the panel, which is, you know, when they've duetted with hot acts of the time, and that's
right.
It worked.
Mm-hmm. And duets were hot throughout the 80s too. I mean, I remember a lot of duets, you know, going into the top 10 during the 80s. But then also with John Lennon duetting with Elton John for Whatever Gets You Through the Night. I thought there was, you know, no other bigger act at that time than Elton John. So, Ken Michaels, what else did you have that you wanted to get to?
Well, I wanted to just bounce off of what Kit said about Paul and Michael Jackson, because I think the two of them, the most important thing is how they sounded together and how good the music was. And they really had great chemistry. And between Say, 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 and I know a lot of people put down The Girl Is Mine because it's too cutesy, but as a duet,
It's L7.
you know, they really work together well. It reminds me of those, you know, duets where each person is answering each other. And, you know, I think it's a well-executed record. I also like The Man. And I know a lot of people say it's way too syrupy, and it is very syrupy, but there is a great example of the two of them harmonizing well together.
Their harmonies were on point, absolutely.
Yeah, and I kind of wish that Paul and Michael did more work together. I think that, you know, there was great chemistry, even on screen. I mean, the Say, Say, Say video was fantastic. The two of them look great together in that video. And then you also have to bring up Stevie Wonder, because, you know, Ebony and Ivory was a number one hit for 7 weeks. And I also like the duet of What's That You're Doing on Tug of War. But Ebony and Ivory, you know, I always defend that song. It's a simple message. It's a powerful message. There are some people who point to that song as well as the work that Paul did with Michael as the nadir of his career. And you know, I don't feel that way. But how do you feel, Ken?
Well, you know, Ken, it's a sad irony that you have to see that you have to defend a song about peace.
Yeah. It is true.
I mean, it had to be said.
That's true. Yeah. Yep.
Very sad irony indeed.
Yeah.
If anything, I could say the same thing about Michael that I would say about Stevie Wonder. Stevie is my favorite person in all of music next to the Beatles.
True.
And he's like the greatest genius, one of the greatest geniuses out there. If anything, I wish that Paul would have done serious work with Stevie Wonder. Sat down, did 50-50 collaborations, you would have had some of the greatest music ever recorded.
Yeah.
You know? And I do love Ebony and Ivory, don't get me wrong, and What's That You're Doing, which was really just the result of a jam from the two of them. But no, I love those two together. And since Paul and Stevie really respect each other so much, it's a crime that they didn't do more together.
Yeah.
Right.
On the bottom, he played harmonica.
They still could, right?
Yeah,
I hope
you know,
so.
I thought What's That You're Doing was extremely good. I like Ebony and Ivory fine, but I really thought that was a great riff that they had going.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I would have loved to have heard Ebony and Ivory as a full-on collaboration between the two, rather than it, you know, pretty much being done when he brought Stevie in to you know, be a duet.
Yeah.
So, but moving up to you know, maybe the dancing or the electronic scene, you know, where Paul was experimenting, you know, in the late 70s and through the 80s with, you know, Press to Play. And then he also had that remix with Hope of Deliverance in the early 90s, I believe it was, on the CD single. But I think he was always looking for that, you know, that latest sound. And I think that working with Youth, I think it came to Reputation with the Electric Arguments album, and I just love how, you know, they blended in, you know worldly music and you know, and dance music and all the combinations of instruments on in each track, especially a song like Universal Here and Everlasting Now, where it starts off with this, you know, that eerie piano, you know, sound, and then it moves into this really fast dance track. And, you know, and then it goes back to this really eerie, you know, piano sound. You know, the stuff like that, I think really works. You know, Paul's constantly searching for that latest sound and working with the producer of the time. And I know he gets flack for that sometimes, but, you know, he constantly wants to grow as an artist. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, I think has worked with him throughout the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and one thing you brought up, and this is something we didn't have time to talk about in the live panel, which was, the Paul's incorporation of dance. You know, he clearly has this affinity for electronica and dance remixes. And I wrote an article about this eons ago for Beatle Fan Magazine, and I got some, you know, people saying, Ew. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is, he recorded a number of them. And, like, I thought the No More Lonely Nights remix on Broad Street was great. You know, I thought it was danceable, but it, you know, had added the horns. And I mean, I thought it was a lot of fun, you know. I liked, this is kind of related to dance, but that Twin Freaks. Freelance Hellraiser. That was great. What they did to What's That You're Doing. I mean, I thought that was a terrific remix, Temporary Secretary. It was a way to bring him in to modern modern sounds, and great for the club, but also great to just listen to. And I know people who didn't care for it at all and said, you know, what does he think he's doing? But I thought it was a great way to update. You know, update a sound with those remixes. And I think Freelance Hellraiser did a great job of doing some remixes, but not fooling around with Paul's voice too much. It still sounded like Paul. I've always kind of admired that about Paul, his willingness to try, you know, different genres like that. And sometimes
wasn't there, you can see it on YouTube, I believe, some years back, Paul doing a Good Night Tonight kind of avant-garde version that was, first of all, I would just like him to do the old song. in fact, what a great addition that would be in this, its 40th anniversary year.
Yeah.
but I digress. I'm sure there'll be many versions on the Back to the Egg. the third version, the skillet version, they're called. Oh, yeah, you get two skillets. It's wonderful. There are no sticks, so that's really nice. I like that he's always been elastic about their music and very comfortable with that. I think the Hellraiser is the best version of that, certainly. I wasn't keen on the No More Lonely Nights, but Hellraiser was exquisite. That was great stuff. I listen to it regularly. I still listen to it.
Me too.
In fact, it is in rotation on my music box.
Yep. Nice. Mine too. Yeah, it made me really fully appreciate Temporary Secretary. When I heard that version, I'm like, this is great. I thought that remix was just fantastic. It really made me appreciate that song a lot more.
You know, it occurs to me Temporary Secretary would be a great soundtrack for your handwriting.
Yeah,
you
there know, you go.
The kind of piercing techno sound.
That's right.
Yeah, I can hear it. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Well, I'm glad to hear all of you say this because I'm a big fan of all the dance tracks that Paul's done. In particular, I love when he did Ouai Le Soleil. You know, I think it really works, you know.
And we didn't get to that in the panel. That is a great, great song.
Mm-hmm. You like it?
I do. It has an excellent build to it.
Right.
And, you know, after we heard Chris Thomas tell us those stories, particularly the ones about Paul in the final stages of rounding out an album and his difficulty in making those choices. And, you know, I don't say that that's a flaw. I think it's just part of him as an artist. You have to wonder, you know, if we could have received more music like that, if he'd let himself go in a direction like that and maybe take that risk. It could have been fantastic.
He has said that he has difficulty picking what he thinks are his best songs because he likes all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do? You take advice from people, and what if you don't agree with them? You know, it's not an easy, you know, decision to make. But the dance tracks that he's done, I'm glad you mentioned No More Lonely Nights. Do you know how clever it is to take the same words that you used in a ballad version and create a totally different song with it? Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I love about the play out version of No More Lonely Nights.
Yep.
You know, I don't get as much into like when there's 5-6 mixes of the same song, like Uwe Last LA. But the album version, I love it. You know, I go for that all the time. And Twin Freaks, it's interesting that you say that, because when that first came out, it was way too weird for me. I'm saying, what is he doing here? But, you know, most of the songs that the solo Beatles have done, I like for the most part. But there's always those songs that I don't think as much of. Mm-hmm. And the thing I like about Twin Freaks is that it takes certain songs that I didn't appreciate that much and gives it a different spin.
Exactly.
Like, for example, Darkroom, you know, which I don't think is that great a song. But the backing that he puts to that, actually, one of the most brilliant things on Twin Freaks was, and I love Coming Up. You don't need to improve Coming Up. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you mix the backing of Morse Moose and the Grey Goose with Coming Up, who would have thought that? You know? And I'm wondering if this is all the
Hellraiser, that's who.
But you got to have a mind for that. You know, I don't know if Paul even thinks about these things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a brilliant thing. Long-Haired Lady, you should check out, because they isolate the part where Paul and Linda sing Love is Long.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Part, and you just hear the vocals. And it's really cool, you know, to hear it that way. But, you know, there is an art to blending different songs together, what we call mashups. And then a lot of what's on Twin Freaks are not really mashups. They're just taking, like, Paul's vocals and speeding up the beats to it, or doing something with the rhythm and the beats and giving it a different flavor, you know, beefing it up a little bit and making you hear the song in a different way. And if you've gone to Paul's concerts in recent years, he will, before his concerts, he'll run this music for like half an hour, which is very much like Twin Freaks.
Yes.
Right. He's expanded on that. There's a lot of Beatles songs that are in there, and there's covers of Beatles songs in there. And I think it's really cool.
I stay
in my seat listening to all of
it. Yeah, I do too.
And trying to figure out, has he updated it since the last time I saw him? And, you know, are there things here that I heard the last time? You know, but I really like when he does this.
Yeah.
Party is another one that I get into. Transpiritual Stomp from the first Fireman album.
I like that too.
So,
well, you know, there's what it turns on, and, you know, picking up what you were saying there, Ken, is there's so many wonderful moments, right? And they're often just absolutely that, a great moment of sound that occurs for sometimes even once in a song. It's not even repeated. But his moments are so fascinating and, you know, for lack of a better word, catchy, that somebody like Hellraiser in his DJ guise picks up on those and gives us a very different listen of those sounds.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Cool. I can't remember which one it is based upon, but the song La Lula, L-A-L-U-L-A. Do you remember that one? That's my favorite one. It's the 10th track.
Right.
It's the 10th track on the CD version I have. I bought the records when they first came out. I had to have it. I just like the cover.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yep. Well, that's mainly an instrumental that was new.
Right.
Yeah.
As far as I know. But at the same time, you've got what he did with Live and Let Die was kind of interesting, because you kept hearing the same phrase when you were young over and over and over.
Right.
I don't know if you'd find that annoying or find it interesting. So it's so repetitious with that.
Right.
Then to use a song like Really Love You, which
that
to
was
me,
good.
You know, don't get me wrong, people are going to condemn me for this because Ringo's on the track, but I always thought Really Love You was the weakest song on Flaming Pie. Mm-hmm. And by giving it this new arrangement, it made me appreciate it more.
I agree.
Although, you know, Really Love You also has that element of spontaneity to it, which a lot of people like. You know?
Yep.
So
now
Twin Freaks was great.
Yeah, I love it. Now, a listener just did, and this is really funny because I have this in my chicken scratch.
How could we verify that? Yeah, we can.
Uh-huh. But I seriously do. They viewer writes, P.S. Love Me Do is another example of a different approach. Yeah, now that, for me, that's an example of when it didn't work. You know, it sounded forced. It sounded, you know, it just didn't work with those two songs. And that, to me, was an example of being unsuccessful
right.
Incorporating a trend. And I think there's a reason that was not released in the U.S.
Right. Perfect segue, because I was just going to bring that up. Is there any moments throughout any of the solo Beatles where you thought they incorporated a genre or a style into their music that didn't work, Ken Michaels?
Not really. You know, we haven't talked about Press to Play, which to me is the most underrated of all of Paul McCartney's solo albums. And what I have found in talking to Beatle fans through the years is that there are plenty of them that are so used to the Beatle Paul and the Paul in the 70s that had a certain style, that had a certain sound, and was very used to it, not only songwriting-wise, but production-wise. If you take a look at what Paul was doing in the 70s, with the exception of Back to the Egg, he produced all of his solo music. As the 80s came into play, after George Martin, he started to work with the hot producers of the time. And I think a lot of fans... You've seen it online, who don't want him to try to sound contemporary. They want the old Paul. Just like there are people who will listen to Press to Play and they love Only Love Remains and they love Footprints, but they don't like Talk More Talk, except the podcast, of course.
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
And Pretty Little Head. But I thought that it was so well executed, and it was the sound of the times. And to me, you know, I don't even call it dated, because if this music is constant in your life, it's never really dated. Mm-hmm. Pretty Little Head, as you and I have discussed many times, Kit, to me, it always sounds like a Peter Gabriel track. It could have worked as something Peter Gabriel would have done. Talk More Talk, I think, was done so well. And yet there are some fans who think, well, who is he trying to be? Phil Collins here? You know, why can't Paul try to adapt to the sounds of the time if he happens to like it and it really fits well for him? Maybe instead of thinking about whether or not it works for the artist, maybe the problem is the fan who can't adapt to change. So the same people who can't stand Temporary Secretary. Give me Waterfalls, you know, give me One of These Days. But don't give me Temporary Secretary or Bogey Music or those songs. They don't want Paul to go too far left field from what they've expected from him all these years. But I admire him for when he has tried. And, you know, I don't think that the Press to Play material, the experimental stuff like Talk More Talk, is that much more different than She's Given Up Talking on Driving Rain or The Fireman, Electric Arguments. Or something like Road from New. It's all very, you know, electronic, atmospheric. You know, it's got that sound to it. And I think he does it all really well.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, there are times, though, you know, moving on from Paul for just a second and looking at my notes here. That's another thing, which is George Harrison. Now, most of the time, you know, his songs were very... you know, contemporary, they don't really date, but there were a couple where he used, like, to me, used synthesizers too much. Like Wake Up My Love from Gone Troppo. That I would have liked that song a lot better if they just removed that, because it starts the album out like that. And to me, I just think, oh, this is just trying to incorporate a modern sound. Kind of similar to Blood from a Clone. Is another one that, and also, of course, the lyrics are just, you know, so you're just like, oh, man, this guy, he is angry. But besides that, you know, I just thought those two songs to me haven't aged as well. And I just felt like he was kind of forcing a modern sound in there, and it didn't need to be there. And, you know, just in my view.
Womack, anywhere in the solo canon that you felt was lacking in inspiration or anything like that?
Sure, there are several moments. And, you know, what's interesting is they're, you know, you might even call them failures at times, but that's okay. Failure is not a bad thing. You know, that's right. How, you know, what is the phrase that we think about now is fail faster. You know, the more times you work on something and come up short, the closer you are to finding whatever your art demands, whether it's sound or visual or video or what have you. So I've never struggled with that too much. Sometime in New York City is a low point for John Lennon. He certainly came back from that in fine style. The project probably was problematic from the get-go.
Yeah.
You know,
you because it was too political?
No, I don't mean that at all, actually. I like the political impetus for it. Just the playing, you know, but I think about this a lot. You know, there's still people, right? You know, we love them and they have moments of true genius, but they're people. And so much is what is created with human beings is so contextual and it's based on whatever's happening to them at the moment. And so you can mirror these careers that we're talking about with the external forces or rather the internal forces in their lives. And so we spent a lot of time tonight for one reason or another talking about Paul McCartney in the 1980s, which is there's a lot of great music there and music that I adore. I mean, you could make two greatest hits albums out of the wonderful music and many of those songs that aren't even hits, right? That just were flat out great. But having said that, somewhere in there he loses himself in the 1980s. And he had such a big head of steam. Why did that happen? I think that's fascinating. It's not a bad thing. It's just fascinating to me. That he does that. And you mentioned a moment ago, Kit, George Harrison, you know, had some tough times there.
Yeah.
Finds himself in magnificent style more than once. You know, that's what all of this is a journey. And it's the longer you're on the journey, you know, the more kinds of failures you encounter. And that's a very good comment there.
Yeah.
About failure and masterpiece. But even if it's a real failure, it's a failure that's going to take you perhaps to the place where you can create a masterpiece. You know, it's quite interesting. Now, of course, the problem, and it's always going to be the challenge with the solo Beatles, right, is that they come after the Beatles. You know, so any trying to measure anybody against a musical fusion that goes straight up and then ends in such a magnificent fashion is folly, right? So, you know, the most challenging thing for the solo Beatles is Beatles.
Well, yeah. I think that because they had to follow the Beatles, it's been impossible for so many people to really assess the solo work. How can you? You know, just to be fair, you know, if everything has to be measured up against what they did as a band, you might as well not listen to anything else. You know, I mean,
no, that's right.
It's just not fair to do that. But I kind of disagree what you were saying, Ken, about like the mid 80s with Paul. I think that from Press to Play on, like Press to Play through Flaming Pie was his Renaissance period overall.
Wow.
But the period going from Give My Regards to Broad Street into Press to Play, actually Press to Play into Flowers in the Dirt. He's looking for different producers to work with. He's not sure who he wants to work with, whether it's David Foster here or, you know, there's a lot of different producers and engineers on Flowers in the Dirt, but yet the material is so strong. And then Elvis Costello.
To be fair, Ken, he had an album rejected by Columbia, you know, during that period that he worked on with David Foster. So it's a tough period and the material wasn't always, you know, that strong, but life is like this, you know, he just has more of this than most people.
Right. But, you know, those albums for the most part, Press to Play through Flaming Pie were brilliant. Mm. Off the Ground is very erratic.
Yeah.
But then if you add all the bonus tracks that we had from CD singles, it's brilliant stuff on Off the Ground too. So, but that's like you said, Ken, that's the nature of all artists, you know.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
What about you, Tom?
Well, I kind of, you know, agree with Ken Womack a little bit about sometime in New York City. I think some of it works and some of it don't work. I mean, as a style of music, I mean, well, the late 60s, early 70s, all that political music, you know, was big. And Lennon was right in there, you know, head first. And some of it worked, in my opinion. Some of it didn't. I think the singles worked very much. Power to the People and yeah. You know, and War is Over, you know, Happy Christmas. But the album itself, I think, was loose. It wasn't really, you know, I think it was kind of sloppy at times throughout the album. And, you know, it might have been too much. Maybe throw in a ballad or, you know, Luck of the Irish. I don't really consider that a ballad. But, you know, Woman is the Nigger of the World might have been a little too much for that time. I mean, I don't knock the song. I think it's a good song. But I think it was maybe just a little too harsh for that time. But other than that, I think that's the only part in Lennon's career where I saw any kind of, you know, low spot, in my opinion. So,
but in a way, I kind of find it interesting that he went with Elephant's Memory for that album.
Right.
He was looking for more of a garage sound, you know, not a slick produced
right.
album. You know, it's completely different from Imagine in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
right.
I love the fact that he took a detour there and did something different. Whereas Mind Games is more a continuation of Imagine,
mm-hmm.
you know, as an album. But maybe, well, now Woman is the Negro of the World is one of my favorite John Lennon songs.
Right.
I think it was one of the most brilliant of all the songs, especially working in the sax part in there with the orchestration.
Yeah.
But maybe you feel that way, Tom. Could it be possibly because it was half Yoko?
No, not at all.
No,
not at all. I mean, as the years go on, I really appreciate more and more, you know, the Yoko stuff. So that part didn't bother me. I mean, I would imagine that it probably bothered, you know, the fans at the time, you know, that Yoko was getting so much vocals on what we were supposed to have a John Lennon record. And then here's Yoko, you know, taking half of the album. And maybe people were probably expecting, you know, just to hear her wail throughout the album. And I think that's one of Yoko's downfalls was we had that, you know, that screeching first and not her singing first, you know? So,
mm-hmm.
I think people were kind of, you know, maybe misled on that fact, but you know, it's, you know, like I said, I mean, I think it's almost kind of like living in the material world, which, you know, don't get me wrong. I think it's a great album, but you know, a lot of people think it's too preachy, you know,
right.
And then with, you know, but with, sometime in New York City, I think it's just, you know, a little too much, you know, statement song or political song or, you know, whatever. So,
right.
Well, you know, I think what's sort of the case with just sort of taking off where you left off, Ken, about, you know, the period in the 80s, the mid 80s, where Paul was sort of, you know, trying, you know, he had the album rejected, he was working with different producers and that kind of stuff. You know, I think that's the thing. I think all of them at one point or another got to a point in their careers where they thought, okay, am I going to keep doing the same thing or am I going to, you know, try and keep, well, not even just keep up, but I mean to sound more modern and incorporate into my music without it sounding inauthentic, you know. And,
right.
and yeah, and that is hard. That is hard to do. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, Paul, I think in the mid 80s, you know, struggled with it a bit, like Spies Like Us. You know, that's become this hated single, which I
not
don't
by hate. Me.
Yeah, no, I don't, not I at all.
I don't hate it, but I mean, you know, but a lot of people point to that. I think, you know, you hear some of the outtakes of other stuff he did. And I mean, I think, you know, he was just experimenting. He was trying to figure out where he fit in this, you know, contemporary landscape. I think
mm-hmm.
George through that process, you know, after Gone Troppo and taking that time off. Ringo, I mean, you know, we talked about a little bit at the fest. He tried disco. I mean, you know, he tried different things. You know, and John wasn't, I guess you would say double fantasy. I mean, reviews that came out for that at the time said, oh, it was capitalizing on the soft rock of the 80s, you know, the soft sound. And you know, I think it's aged a lot better sense, but I think, you know, but he was, you know, accused of that for a while.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, with Double Fantasy, a lot of the reviews at the time were that Yoko's stuff was stronger than John's and sounded more modern. And with John was more a continuation of the same thing.
Right.
And I think we look back at John's songs at Double Fantasy now and look at them, certainly like Woman and Watching the Wheels as real masterpieces. But, you know, if you follow what John said right before he was murdered, he was into a lot of the music of the late 70s, whether it was Talking Heads, The Cars. You know, he mentioned bands like those. You have no idea what direction John's music would have taken. The only thing we do know is Walking on Thin Ice, which he was involved with for Yoko's song. But it's really a shame that apart from losing this tremendously talented, one of the greatest songwriters ever, we really don't know where he would have gone musically. Right. You know, he could have gone in a lot of different directions.
Right.
Then, yeah, Paul could have
been like Blondie, you know.
Sure, but there's a beautiful song. I'm sure you've heard the demo that he was working on about 15 days before he died, called Help Me to Help Myself, which has a very interesting kind of almost gospelish tinge to it.
Right.
You know, with descending chords. It was quite beautiful. I was listening to it today, which is why I was thinking about it.
Yeah, it's just John at the piano doing that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the success of Spies Like Us, you know, the fact that it made it to the top 10, I think that kind of gave Paul maybe the confidence to, you know, go the way the production did for Press to Play, you know, even though that was, you know, the way he was kind of leaning towards anyways. But I, you know, it you know, press people are going to have their opinions of Press to Play, and that's fine. And, you know, it grew on me. It definitely grew on me. You know, I didn't really care for it at first, and there's still some tracks that I don't care for. But, you know, as we said throughout this episode, we definitely applaud the man for trying something different.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, you never really ever see him put out an album of all one thing. Like, you'll never get an album of Talk More Talks. Yeah. You will get the ballad mixed in there and some rockers, you know. Well, once Paul becomes aware of this show, there's going to be more Talk More Talks, I'm
absolutely
sure of it.
Absolutely.
Right. But, we're that influential.
Yeah.
It's happening.
And then we could also talk about most recently with Egypt Station, you know, working with Ryan Tedder, for one, which I thought was a great combination. I mean, Nothing for Free, which was one of the bonus tracks for the Target version, is one of the best songs on the album, and it sounds very contemporary to me.
My favorite.
Right.
Yeah.
Great song.
And I know a lot of people cut down Fuh You. I didn't like the gimmickry of Fuh You, but I like the melody, and I like the whole arrangement of it all. So, I like when he tries to, you know, to sound contemporary by working with some of the hot names of today, because they, you know, the thing is that no matter how contemporary Paul tries to sound, the top 40 stations of today are not going to play him.
Right.
It doesn't matter if it's the greatest song, the greatest hook. It doesn't matter if he did a Band on the Run for 2019. Top 40 is not going to play Paul McCartney. And Nothing for Free by any other artist, the new artist of today, sounding just like that would be a hit, you know. But radio being what it is, caring more about their demographic audience and feeling that young people are not going to listen to a guy in his upper 70s and his latest album, you know, that's just the way that it is. But it works when he does work with these people.
All right. Well,
we didn't talk about Kanye West, though. We didn't talk about Kanye West. How can you miss Kanye?
We'll do a 2000s episode down the road.
I could do a whole episode of Kanye, so let's get on that.
Okay.
Anyways.
I'm getting yelled at from the other room.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, then, Ken Womack, why don't you lead us off on what you got coming up, and, you know, if you want people to get a hold of you to say hi, you know, what's going on in your world?
I'm heading to Washington, D.C. in a couple of days. Going to do a talk with our colleague Tom Kitts at Kramer's Books in D.C. And going to go to the Pop Culture Association. So I hope to see some of our listeners there. It's going to be a good time.
Cool. And for this show, Talk More Talk, you can email us at talkmoresolotalk@gmail.com. Check us out on Twitter at TalkMoreTalk1, or you can reach us on our Facebook page. Like the Facebook page, and that's how you can see us live, and that's Talk More Talk. And Ken Michaels, how can people get a hold of you, and what do you got going on these days?
You can reach me by email, which is everylittlething@att.net. And, of course, there's my website, which is kenmichaelsradio.com. I want to mention two quick things here, because a few weeks ago, I did a very interesting interview with a guy named Mark Mann. Mark Mann has a long history in the music business, but he became friends with Jeff Lynne around the time of the Traveling Wilburys. And he had a background in audio technology and audio software, which led him, get this, folks, to do the cleaning up for the cassette demos